Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.
Welcome to Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, here on News Talk. And over the next hour, we're going to be looking at the latest developments in business and politics, both at home here in Ireland and right across the globe. On today's show, we're going to be exploring the huge interest in AI among tech leaders in Ireland. But we'll also be looking at why the interest hadn't actually translated itself into widespread action just yet. Ronan Walsh from EY will be joining us to look at the latest insights into the world of artificial intelligence. And then shifting gears, we're going to turn our attention to the hospitality sector, where Irish hotels have undergone a significant amount of changes in recent years. And now with news of three new global players entering the market, we're going to dissect the current landscape of the industry. And finally, we'll raise a pint to the global phenomenon that is Guinness. With its recent rise to become the UK's favourite pint, we'll explore how Guinness has successfully expanded its consumer base. I'll be joined here in studio by Frank McNally from the Irish Times to look at that. You can email me at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. For our first item today, you'll notice over the past number of weeks, we've been talking a lot about AI. And while we've actually looked at it from very different perspectives, Irish businesses, are they actually using it themselves? And do they have the proper knowledge that they need to utilise it properly? Well, Ronan Walsh is head of technology at EY, and they have recently released their annual Tech Leaders Outlook for 2024. So he's here to tell us all about what the business community think. Ronan, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Thank you, Mandy. Very happy to be here.
Now, just talk to us, Ronan, a little bit first about who exactly you're talking to and what they said. What's the kind of top line of what they said back to you?
So the top line, essentially coming back from 150 tech leaders across Ireland, across multiple sectors, financial services, med tech, manufacturing, retail, etc. The top line messages coming back to them are very simple. Cyber remains the main concern that boards are looking at the moment. The threat is increasing. The focus area immediately after that is talent and ensuring that you have enough talent in your business to, one, manage the day-to-day, but two, plan for the future. And then finally, businesses are looking at the transformative benefits that AI and other associated technologies can bring to their business over time.
I'm taking it that there's a lot of interest amongst the business community, and you've obviously got a widespread and a good kind of mix of the type of businesses you're looking at. They're interested, they're intrigued. Are they actually doing anything about it?
It's an interesting question. There is a huge amount of interest and hype around AI everywhere. There's no sector that isn't looking at it, talking about it. But in the main, we're finding our businesses and our clients are very concerned about protecting their businesses. Cyber, number one. Talent, number two. Maintaining the business as it stands and doing, you know, the normal run-of-the-mill transformative projects that are occupying them. Many of them are adopting a wait-and-see. Mm. I think the concerns that these leaders express to us are a lot on the table in terms of running their day-to-day businesses. AI is definitely on the agenda. They recognize that a specific set of skills are needed to build AI capability. And many of them are looking in the marketplace to see how that develops and how they can play into it. Mm. But they are aware that it is hitting levels of adoption among the general public and their employees. Mm. They need to be aware of how to take it forward, but they are being very, very careful in terms of how they step into that space.
Yeah, and I thought that was very interesting about the figures, because it's very, you know, in the bigger sense, you know, the AI and how it adapts to the, applies to the workplace is a sort of a new thing, but it isn't new because, of course, we've all been using AI in various different ways for a long time. Do you think that the reason why they're not planning appropriately or not embracing it more is because a little bit of fear there, maybe?
I think there could be some concerns, and some of them are real. And I don't want to link everything to cyber, but there is a very healthy conversation going on across governments everywhere, businesses everywhere, in terms of using ethical and policy-driven AI. The hackers that are out there using the same tools are not in any way constrained. So the concerns come around very much to how should we use it to advance our business interests, but how do we prepare for others that are looking potentially to damage our business? So it is, what skills are needed? What threats should we be ready for? But what transformative benefits should we also be ready to take care of? And a lot of it comes back into skills that are needed to take it forward. Are people cautious about it? I think they're watching it in the context of how it changes other people's business, and they're getting ready to take advantage.
Mm.
Nobody wants to be first, but many want to be fast second.
Yeah, yeah. So they want to learn from the mistakes of others. Look, that's always the safety net, really, isn't it? But you've mentioned cybersecurity multiple times now. It's something that not only business has to contend with, but also government. We have the anniversary, obviously, of that HSE hack earlier this week. So is that an area maybe that, as we go on, something like AI could help businesses tremendously in? And how should they approach preparing for that and embracing cybersecurity from an AI perspective?
That's a really good question, because I think the two are linked, particularly with easy access to tools by everyone. There's a proliferation of the tools, and many of the providers have made them free to use. And they're free to use by people that may not have good intentions. In terms of how do you prepare for a very aggressive and highly complex AI-driven cyber or rogue AI attacks, there is a requirement to increase the awareness around cyber. It is one of our findings in the context of speaking to AI and technology leaders, that awareness is a core element to building up your cyber defenses. There is always a competition or a competitive aspect at board level to addressing the concern, where, for example, cyber, significant cost is needed to protect versus a competing demand for an IT budget that is easily measured in terms of return, whether it's acquiring new customers or creating new opportunities elsewhere. It is absolutely critical that the awareness of cyber threats, the complexity of those threats, and the need to prevent and prepare to deal with those threats has appropriate budget and also has AI baked into it, because the hackers definitely are embedding AI capability into their threats, and all businesses need to prepare for AI-loaded cyber defences also.
It did seem, looking at your figures, that the issue of data protection, at least, and the responsibility to, users, customers, consumer, is registering high, isn't it, still? So that's a good thing, that new awareness that companies have.
I think that's very important. I mean, if you look at traditional businesses going back a number of years, the core data that businesses ran on was buried deep back in the center of a business, highly protected, difficult to get at, typically in a business-owned data center. The world has moved on in the last even 10 years, and you can see from some of the stats, even on cloud adoption, many businesses are now very comfortable placing lots of their data in cloud-based platforms. What that actually translates into, a lot of data on the move, a lot of data put in the hands of various people within the business to drive their business forward. As you move data around, you have to have a policy and systems that protect your core asset.
Yeah, I was interested in the issue of the cloud, and I think it said the figures doubled year on year to 30.
That's right.
Why is that? Is it a capacity issue, or is it become more familiar with it?
I think on the one hand, if you're working in the business long enough, many years ago, cloud was the new technology. There was, hype around what it could do. Then there was a general level of awareness built up. Then there was skills to match it, and ultimately adoption followed. And what we're actually seeing is significant amounts of easy, if there is a word, easy adoption, where clients are comfortable that their very important workloads can now be placed in the cloud, their important data can be placed in the cloud, and they can move on to other things that drive their business forward. And the reason and rationale for that is the cloud is proven to be extremely safe. The providers are highly skilled. They understand the threats that are outside of those cloud platforms, and they secure the cloud for it and your data in the cloud. And as a consequence, businesses are now comfortable placing their assets, their data assets with them.
Mm. And it's even, I think, down to the individual as well. You know, you might have a technology expert in your company. The whole IT department might be fully au fait with the cloud. It's that fear factor again for me that sometimes the individual, do I trust that? Do I know enough about it to even use it? So I think it's very interesting to see those figures shift so fundamentally there. If you're just tuning in, folks, you're listening to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston and I'm chatting to Ronan Walsh, who is head of technology at EY. And we're talking about their annual Tech Leaders Outlook for 2024. Ronan, of course, the other thing that you mentioned that was on the minds of business leaders that you spoke to was the issue of the area of talent. You know, there isn't an industry or sector out there that doesn't have an awareness about a skills shortage, you know, a people shortage. But I'm a bit surprised that this is an issue for this industry, because you would have thought in recent years a lot of the graduates are coming out are, number one, tech savvy and driven toward those techno jobs. So why is there such a lack of people in this area?
I think it's less of a lack and it's more of a demand within okay. businesses.
We didn't produce enough.
And businesses are changing. So if you look at many of the businesses that we engage with at the moment, traditionally there would have been a very clear separation between, for example, your HR function. They managed HR, finance, they managed finance, sales managed sales. And everyone had a particular way to do it and they were less tech hungry, even 10 years ago. Now everybody is involved to a significant extent in technology. So HR have HR analytics, for example.
Okay.
Finance operations have finance operation analytics. They want to forecast forward.
What right, you find, so it's permeating throughout
all
an organization.
Parts of the
yeah, it's not that one person in a cupboard
exactly,
just looking after
exactly.
the IT department.
Now everybody has demands and needs that need to be served through IT or tech-enabled solutions. All departments in any of the clients that we work with are data hungry.
Mm.
They all want to be served with data that tells them how their particular part of the business is performing today and potentially forming tomorrow. So it's less of we're not producing enough. It's the demand in all parts of all of our clients' businesses are now tech heavy and tech hungry.
Is there a lot of movement in the tech sector from a personnel point of view?
There is and there isn't, I guess. I mean, it's there's a couple of different aspects to the answer. What we typically see, and if you were to take it from graduate up, graduates want to find, particularly in technology, they want to find businesses that will give them those rich experiences. 20, 30 years ago, you would have been lined up to do one particular job. You were a database administrator, or you were a server administrator, or you were the security person. Now graduates and young professionals want a mix of experiences, mm. and it is a better way of forming a full end-to-end technologist. As a consequence, they pick and choose businesses that will offer them rich experiences. So it's not just, certainly our experience and our clients, it's not just about a financial package. It's now about a rich set of experiences over a period of time.
Mm.
Successful businesses recognize that and, you know, provide graduates and young professionals those opportunities to stay.
Mm. And that's a really important point. I think in COVID as well, there was a sort of new appreciation that a job wasn't just about salary, that you had to have more added value. Maybe
yes.
that's just, they're just yeah. a product of that generation who now rightfully expect that. We spoke about AI in relation to cyber security and how you can understand there could be things very easily adapted and learned within companies to help from an AI perspective. I just want to get your opinion on talent acquisition and AI. And I'm not talking about talent acquisition and replacing individuals. I'm talking about in that actual process of talent acquisition. I've heard lots of people of late say that they went to an interview and the first round was to a computer screen, and if you don't have the right touch words on your CV, you can't get through an algorithm. But are there AI tools that you can actually use that are positive, maybe to help a company that we just hear the bad side of it, but is there a good AI?
There are. I mean, there's a number of different fields, for example, that would use, you know, AI today in a very, and it's not to say that your use case is bad or wrong, but there are some that are very obviously good. if you look at some of the AI technology that is focused on image recognition, it is definitely a technology that will assist, for example, in the medical field where images need to be processed at high speed to a high level of accuracy. If you train an AI model to look at images and you demonstrate or you train the model over a period of time that these are the factors and markers you're looking for, these are the ones that are indicating, you know, something needs to be assessed, the AI model at that point can be very, very effective in supporting people as they look at images and potentially make decisions. If you look at customer contact centers, and we all engage with contact centers, everybody is looking for that good experience with somebody who understands their particular use case, whether it's an insurance claim or some, you know, help me booking my tickets to.
And you feel that has to be a human, because you feel that they need to be empathetic toward your particular situation.
And what you find is with AI is looking to make people more productive in that first contact. And everyone is more comfortable when you get on the phone and it's, you know, hello, your first name, and I recognize your case and I see what we've done, and let me take you through how we're going to fix it and forward it. AI can help with that because it can stitch various pieces of information together for that experience.
Mm.
And the very next call, it'll stitch a different set of information together for that caller.
Because it's learning as it goes.
Because it's learning as it goes.
And I suppose it can do all that faster and quicker than we can.
And the point around and the advent of AI has been around for a very long time. You touch on something that's very important. What has caught up with it is the compute power to use the models to consume the data. And what would have taken days and months in the past is now taking seconds. And that's really, really the big game changer.
Well, Ronan, I think this research is a fascinating insight to the minds of our business leaders. So thank you for being with us and sharing all of that with us today. That was Ronan Walsh, who's head of technology at EY. Ronan, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Now, lots more to come on today's show. Irish hotels have gone through a major shift in their business model in recent years. And with reports this week of new entrants into the markets, we're going to look at what's happening in that sector. I'll be back with all of that right after this short break. Hey, welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, the latest annual Deloitte Crane report, which looks at building developments across residential and commercial properties in Ireland, has called 2023 a stellar year for the sector, with an estimated 1,650 new hotel bedrooms being opened in that year. But with higher tax and increased competition, can this strong recovery maintain its momentum in 2024? Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by Michael Magner, who's president of the Irish Hotels Federation, and also Ellie Donnelly, who's a senior business reporter with the Business Post. You're both very welcome to Taking Stock. Now, Michael, I'm going to start with you. You took over as president of the Irish Hotels Federation in February, I think it was, of this year. But before we get stuck into all the facts and figures, just tell us exactly who it is you represent and how many people work in that part of the sector.
So I took over as national president of the Irish Hotels Federation at the end of February this year. And the Irish Hotels Federation is the main representative body representing hotels and guest houses across Ireland. We currently have a membership of nearly 1,000 or almost 1,000 hotel and guest house members. And that represents a workforce of 70,000 people, which is part of the wider ecotourism sector, where there are over 270,000 people employed.
Mm. Now, the reason I wanted to do this was when I looked at that Deloitte report, it actually started making me think about the wider hotel landscape. And if you think of it as an industry, it's gone through like remarkable changes in recent years. The global pandemic, obviously. But if you go back to 2019, what was that landscape like? Like, the economy was doing really well. There was lots of tourism coming in. And then 2020, absolutely nothing for the sector beyond the support that they got from government. Then they had to transition into appealing to Irish people who were stuck on this island and how they would attract them to various different hotels and deal with all the issues that COVID brought with us. Then they had the refugees from war. Then they had an Irish population again dealing with cost of living crisis. They had their own issues with the energy crisis themselves. Now the economic migrants and possibly nowhere to put new tourists should they come in. And when I was looking at it and thinking about it, of all of the indigenous industries, I think that this has been the most volatile and complex of them all. So, Michael, as you looked out as a new president coming in, as you look out at 2024, what are the prospects and the outlook for that sector like?
Well, that's an excellent summary of the challenges that the hospitality and wider tourism industry have faced and continue to face. The hospitality and tourism sector, the hotel sector, is the largest indigenous industry in Ireland. It's ahead of agriculture. And as I mentioned at the start, there's 270,000 people employed. What we have seen in the sector over the last 18 months is an absolute avalanche of incredible costs of doing business, not just from the area of labour costs, which is well flagged, but also everything that we're selling out now that we have to purchase in to sell has got an additional inflationary cost connected to it. So if you were to ask me about the outlook, if 12 or 18 months ago, I would have said the outlook for 2024 was positive. Asking about the outlook into 2025, I'm a lot more cautious in relation to it, because we have concerns. We have concerns that our, we'll say, hotel sector is being potentially damaged and eroded because of costs of doing business. Because what we need to remember is that in the hotel sector, 71% of all registered accommodation are 70 bedrooms or less in terms of hotel stock. Wow. So a hotel with 70 bedrooms. And with that, most of those businesses are primarily food and beverage led. So that means that the majority of those businesses, their turnover is connected to food and beverage, and has been well flagged since the start of this year, particularly in the restaurant sector. Hotels are no different. They've seen an absolutely massive avalanche of costs. And with that in mind, then you look at the issues and you say, well, the cost of doing some parts of business is potentially becoming unviable. And those businesses that were originally or sustainable and viable are being really threatened. And if we as an open economy rely on international tourism and tourism visitors to come to our shores, and we don't have the suite of services in terms of a restaurant experience as part of the overall immersive experience and visiting a country or a destination within the country, and the hotels are only offering minimal services from what you would expect a hotel to offer because some of those services are no longer profitable, then it leads me to be very concerned about the overall tourism and the memorable experiences that can be created for visitors to Ireland into the future. So I would say that we are very cautious and sceptical about what's moving forward.
Mm. Ellie, I'm going to bring you in here, and I know that this is a sector that you pay close attention to, but I find that there's so many conflicting messages. You see the place booming, you hear that tourism numbers are on the up, you see new entrants coming into the marketplace as we did this week, and then you hear from the likes of the Dalata Group who don't see things being quite so rosy. And also, as Michael has alluded to there's a multiplicity of problems still facing them. What's your assessment of that? Can you put any sense on whether, you know, the outlook is any better or any worse than Michael has outlined there?
I think for the moment, there's definitely demand for tourism there for sure. The US economy appears to be performing very strong into Ireland and things like that. Probably with Dalata, what you're referring to there is that their revenue per available room, which is the revenue that they would generate for each room, it was down in the first 3 months of this year a little bit. We know that because Dalata is a listed company and therefore it has to publish its results. So what they did actually say was that last year, the first 3 months of 2023 were quite exceptional in terms of events, because you had the visit by the US president in April 2023, which was a huge, huge event, obviously, and would have resulted in a lot of rooms being booked out. But they did also highlight the increase in the VAT rate, which came into effect in September last year, as impacting the business in the early months of this year.
Mm.
And there's demand there.
What has Michael McGrath been saying about that VAT, that question of VAT for hotels of late?
Yes, actually, Michael McGrath spoke to my paper, The Business Post, last month, And he did actually point out that the VAT is a tax on consumers, that it's not a business viability measure. And so he did say in that article that any cut or change to the VAT should result in a change to the price that the consumer is paying. And he said that that wasn't an argument that he was currently hearing. So, I mean, that 13, it went from 9% to 13. The 9% was temporary during COVID times, and then it went back up to 13.5. And that is, in theory, a tax that should be going straight on to the consumer. So whether, I don't know if it's a case that the businesses aren't passing it on to the consumer or if the consumer is unwilling to pay it.
Mm. Michael, I'll bring you back in here then just about that government support and what you want to see from government. We see big supports announced earlier this week for the SME sector by Minister Peter Burke, the new Minister for Enterprise. Will they help your members?
So the supports that the Department of Enterprise and Employment and Minister Burke and approved by Cabinet this week, while they'll help some of our members, the unfortunate reality is that the majority of our members have been excluded. And if I take you back to the point I made, the majority of hotel accommodation in this country is 70 bedrooms or less. So we're not talking about the large operators here. Unfortunately, the business supports, and by the way, some of those supports don't come in until October of this year in terms of the employer PRSI. The majority of those supports don't apply to medium-sized enterprises. So in my own case, with my own hotel, a 70-bedroom property, I applied the supports in terms of what it meant to me, €84 a week is what the support is to my business. And unfortunately, that just isn't enough when 75% of my turnover is on food and beverage. So really what we need is, and I accept the point that Minister McGrath has said about that. However, the reality of it is that while we've tried to pass on some of it because it's a consumer tax, we cannot pass on the entirety of it because the consumers just won't pay it. Mm. There's only so much the consumer will pay for a pizza or for accommodation, etc. So the Hotels Federation and other industry stakeholders as well, not just the Federation, our position is very clear. The reinstatement of that from the 13.5% higher rate needs to be brought back for food to 9%. It is the only way that you can help those struggling businesses that are food-led to help them be sustainable, because we have to have a 7-day-week operation to serve not just the international visitor that was referenced in the North American market. And we need to be careful not to rely fully on the overseas and the North American market. We saw what happened again in our industry in 2001 post September 11th and the ash cloud and so many issues around that. So we're very cognizant that we need to have an international visitor, but also the domestic visitor has to be able to, it's such an important facet to our industry, and we have to be able to provide products and services that are affordable for people, but also that we can have those businesses open 7 days a week. It is the case in many regional towns and villages across the country outside of the larger cities, whereby you cannot get somewhere to eat on a Monday or a Tuesday or even a Wednesday evening now, because restaurants and bars and even some hotel members, they've stopped doing food and they've changed the way of doing business. Is that the way we want to have our hospitality and tourism hotel product delivering experiences for the customer in the future? I don't believe that's the right or the way forward. Mm. So governments need to take a very proactive position on this and say, you know, when you look at the amount of jobs that are implied, and many of those hotels and guest houses are owner operated, they themselves are employers. And something that's often missed as well is the ancillary, economy that's driven.
Yes, the wider reach of the tourists who might go into the area and what they might spend in other shops. We have actually covered that a lot on this programme in the past, but I do take your point, Michael. Ellie, can I bring you back in here then? Is there still an interest, though, in coming into Ireland from those, you know, those big hotel chains and building more?
Absolutely. As you mentioned there earlier, there is a lot of new brands coming into the Irish market, companies like Hoxton, Citizen M, Ruby Hotel, and they followed other recent arrivals like NYX. So there's certainly new brands interested in coming to the market. And I mean, I think the figures from Dublin Airport is a great barometer. Mm. Like the cap is something that we've discussed before, Mandy. And the fact that the airport is almost at that cap, there's huge volumes of people through the airport. And an awful lot of that is tourism. And there's certainly that demand there. So as long as there is demand for coming from tourists, there will certainly be an interest in other hotel operators coming into the market here, I believe.
Yeah, the airport is an interesting one, Michael. I might bring you back in here on this. Myself and Ellie have been blue in the face talking about Dublin Airport and how it's at capacity. And one way or another, it indicates that this city is full. And what about Shannon and Cork Airport? It's just beyond me why some politician doesn't take Shannon Airport and channel some business their way. How do your memberships in the regions in the West compare to Dublin?
So just before I answer that, I just want to come back in on one point about new entrants into the market. While that's accepted, they're coming in, however, to cities. Regional Ireland is seeing no growth in new hotels, no new entrants into the market, because it's cost negative to build hotels or to open new hotels or even to add on to hotels in Ireland now, Ireland.
And that's a very interesting point, Michael, actually, because I was looking at a figure just the other day in preparation for this, that 38% of people who come into Dublin Airport actually head down the country at some point, whether it's for tourism or business. They do go out of Dublin. So that's what I'm asking you. If it's not that, if the new entrants aren't going in there, you know, would you, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but surely there should be a more strategic, higher level ambition to get people into those airports to start moving people around the West.
Well, to look at the airport structure, first of all, what needs to be dealt with is a cap issue at Dublin Airport. And that's a huge concern, because the fact is, most research will tell you when going to an international destination, the capital city tends to be one of those key touch points. And in Ireland, it's Dublin Airport. Now, Dublin Airport is the DAA, it's operated by the DAA, and they also own Cork International Airport. So there is absolutely a possibility that, that traffic could be in there. But if the international visitor demands Dublin first, that issue needs to be solved. As you know, Shannon Airport is privately owned insofar as not within the DAA structure. But I'm very acutely aware that our members and indeed politicians in that part of Ireland or indeed in Cork are very vocal about trying to open up new routes into the airports. And I'm sure that would be welcome, absolutely. But let's deal with the issue with the cap at Dublin Airport first, because that needs to be solved as well. A new runway at the cost of many hundreds of millions, and now like a concern that that it may not be able to reach its capacity because of a cap that was imposed under a planning condition, that has to be resolved. You know, we can't stop people from coming to our shores. And if they're correct, and then we talk about sustainability and green, as long as the right processes and operations are in place in our hotels and guest houses, and we work towards the sustainability, that should offset the carbon burn for aircraft coming into the country, I believe.
Yeah, Ellie, just a final word from you on this. Hotels as an electoral issue for politicians, how important are they locally? We saw what happened in Roscrea recently and Drogheda when they were being repositioned as IPA centres. Are they losing their leverage thanks to the big hotel chains coming in and fulfilling a need that people have in the cities?
I wouldn't necessarily think so. What I think will be an issue for a lot of, an issue that politicians face for a lot of doorsteps, is, as was mentioned on the show, the cost of small business, whether it's the small cafes and restaurants in smaller towns. A lot of them are struggling, and we've seen them closing down. We've seen well-known names and less well-known names closing down. And I think that's going to be something that's facing politicians, is that for a lot of those smaller businesses, the cost of doing the business, the cost of keeping their heads above water, that could be some issue that they face coming into these elections.
Well, no doubt this is going to be an issue in the upcoming local and subsequent general election. So we'll watch it with interest in the coming months. But for now, Michael Magner, President of the Irish Hotels Federation, and Ellie Donnelly, Senior Business Reporter with the Business Post. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to News Talk's Taking Stock. Now, after the break, we'll be looking at how a pint of plain is your only man, not just here in Ireland, but all around the world. I'm going to be joined by Frank McNally from the Irish Times. So stay tuned for that. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now for our final item today, take a quick listen to this. That was, of course, the iconic Guinness advert, The Dancing Man, which anyone of a certain vintage will remember. Guinness has been revered and celebrated and drank on this side of the Irish Sea for decades. But last year, it was revealed that Guinness had usurped Carling as the UK's favourite pint. Not only that, it has become perhaps similar to us here in Ireland, somewhat of a personality trait. But what's driving this globalisation of the black stuff? Well, I'm joined now in studio by Frank McNally, who's chief writer of the Irish Diary with the Irish Times. Frank, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Are you a Guinness drinker, first of all?
Do you know what's funny? You should say this. I was going to say this. I'm not a big Guinness drinker. I will occasionally get stuck into Guinness. But I was in Amsterdam at the weekend. And this ties in maybe with what we're going to talk about. I was in Amsterdam and I went to a fine old Irish pub there called Mulligan's. It's the oldest Irish pub in Amsterdam. Because a friend of mine plays trad music. A friend of mine who emigrated to Holland like 25 years ago and has kids there plays Irish music on Sunday night. And I found myself standing at the bar and they had Guinness on tap and nearly everybody was drinking Guinness. And I thought, I have to drink Guinness because I'm abroad and I'm Irish. And it seemed like the right thing. In Dublin, if I go down, not that I go to Temple Bar, but in the streets, the more fashionable streets of Temple Bar, I'd more likely drink some German wheat beer or one of the craft beers.
It's such a funny thing about us, though. When we're away, it's sort of rude to pass an Irish pub, even though you've spent all that money going to a completely different city. You feel, I better go in here.
I thought I was above this kind of thing, and yet there I was. It was like I was celebrating my Irish identity abroad by having, and it was lovely Guinness, it has to be said, despite the rumours that it doesn't travel.
Well, what led me to talk about this today was two things. Firstly, Frank, you wrote a brilliant piece about the origins of the term or the word or the product Baby Guinness, which we're going to get to in a second. Also, the Financial Times had a fantastic piece recently about this kind of hipsterization, if that's the word, of Guinness and how that came about. But maybe let's go back a bit before we get into where we're at now. The Guinness family have always been ahead of their time, I think, when you think of what they've done for building houses for workers, the strategic assets that they bought around the city, the investment in public space. Just give a flavour of what their origins were here in Dublin.
Yeah, well, I mean, the irony is they started off, Arthur Guinness, the original Arthur Guinness was an arch unionist. You know, he was, Daniel O'Connell would have regarded him with deep suspicions. In fact, I think Daniel O'Connell was behind... there was a Protestant, he regarded like Guinness as a Protestant drink. And so there was for a time, there was an Irish sort of Catholic alternative called, I think it was the Phoenix Brewery, also based so up around James Street, or Thomas Street, that presented itself as a more patriotic beer because Guinness was regarded as with suspicion. And I think there were rumours, you know, in 1798 that he was a spy for the British and so on. But then gradually throughout the 19th century, even though that would have remained, it would have been a Protestant company very until living memory, you know, in the 1950s and 60s. But at the same time, it had built things like the Ivy Flats, which are all quite close to us here, magnificent public housing for poor Dubliners. It put millions into the restoration of St. Patrick's Cathedral and made a much better job of it than the whiskey firm that tried to do the same for Christchurch. So it gradually embedded itself in the Irish consciousness. And you have the very fact that the symbol of Guinness is also, you know, reversed. It's the symbol of the Irish state. And Guinness did it first, I presume. Their harp faces the other way. But when Ireland became an independent state, it basically took a leaf out of Guinness's book obviously it was a very much older symbol, but still it was the harp. So, you know, you have the harp on Guinness's glasses and products, and you have the harp on official envelopes. You know, you can't get a more hard to get a more sort of intense and symbiotic relationship than that.
Exactly. Look, the secret of a perfect pint is a very scientific one, and you'll hear people all over, you know, the world, what was a pint like, and you know what they're talking about. The secret of their absolute perfect sales pitch is a less tangible thing, I suppose, to try and understand. Look at the figures, Frank. The CEO of Diageo recently said that last year the sales in the UK were up a massive 24% just in the UK alone. What do they put that down to?
Do you know, part of it, I'm reading this article in the FT and it's slightly tongue-in-cheek, but part of it undoubtedly is the fact that Ireland and the Irish have become very fashionable over there.
It was funny because I was thinking about Brexit and I was thinking to myself, okay, so they don't want to be in Europe, But all of a sudden, there's this coolness attached to being attached to Irishness and the Irish product.
And then, of course, anyway, London did want to be in Europe, and that didn't. London
That's
didn't vote
true.
For Brexit. So, in particular, this is obviously this article was about the UK in general, but also it focused on London. And in London, they still regard themselves as Europeans. And in London, by and large, it used to be different, but these days we are. All the rage over there from, you know, Irish writers, Irish actors, especially Irish male actors is wonderful. You know, Andrew Scott, Paul Mescal, Colin Farrell, Cillian Murphy, because of these people, we're all suddenly hot by, you know, by extension. And this seems to be a thing. I mean, you can joke about it, but it seems to be part of the identity that in a globalised world, Londoners and people elsewhere are trying to tap into something that seems... tap into an identity that seems to them authentic.
Yeah.
And we're it. We're one of the options.
No, I know it does seem like trite, but I do find it fascinating. There's something clearly going on and it's translating through this product. But I don't know, a bit of it reminds me of like the hipster phase that we all went through where people were kind of balking against the system. Everyone began drinking IPA and growing beards. Even the women were growing beards. Is this about some kind of middle class getting in touch with their working class culture to a pint or something? Do you think there's anything of that about it?
There's a bit of that. And actually the FT was suggesting that Guinness is benefiting ironically from a bit of a, not a backlash, but a turning away from the whole craft beers thing, which maybe came to be seen as a bit pretentious. Whereas, you know, going back to drinking Guinness, it's like a return to basics thing. And yet, as they point out, it's Guinness is and has always been a haven for the sort of pub boars and pedants that love craft beer. Because you can discuss, just as the people discussed how wonderful one craft beer was over another, or the hoppiness of it or whatever, people here, you know, I know them, you know, in every pub in Dublin, there are people expounding on what is the greatest pint they ever had or the greatest like pub for pints they ever had. Everybody's got a theory and... it's endlessly discussed. So obviously the Londoners are tapping into this as well. Now they've realised...
yeah, they're late to the game, but they're doing it. I saw some terms in this as well, which I hadn't heard of, but that might be more about my age, but splitting the G in the perfect dome and the two-pint pour. And it's fascinating, the kind of dialogue that's grown up around this now. Do you think social media, TikTok and all that probably feeds into this?
It's all part of it. I hadn't heard of the splitting the G thing. But, you know, they talk about the two-pint pour now as the proper thing. I remember, you probably remember, in Ireland, it used to be a 3 or 4 pint pour. It used to take 5 minutes to get a pint of Guinness, especially in summer when it was all froth. And this was because back then there was a time when the approved temperature for pint of Guinness was room temperature or 15 degrees. It's now like half that.
I'm amazed that you know all this, Frank.
Yeah,
you know.
I've seen it on all, you see these old promotional thermometers in bars saying 15 degrees, just right, you know. But at some point, I think around the 80s, 90s, the Guinness decided for various reasons, like consumer taste, also, you know, for quality control, they decided that cool Guinness was the way to go. And remember the extra cool Guinness was a thing for a while?
Yes, yes.
I led a mock campaign. It started as a mock campaign in my column at the time. It was a Saturday column against cool Guinness. Kind of as a joke, even though I did actually dislike the really cool Guinness. People wrote to me from all over Ireland, genuine people, especially older people saying,
really?
Thank God somebody is finally raising
the sense has prevailed.
And they would write in with letters about from how they used to get one old woman got her glass of Guinness placed in a kettle of hot water for 10 seconds before she drank it. Somebody else put theirs in the microwave for a few seconds. I mean, one of the lads from, what do you call them, the band from the West, the Saw Doctors, they were a member. They were a fully paid up
really,
member.
Really, yeah, yeah.
I think they're...
I nearly said Westlife, but they don't strike me as Guinness.
I think they're local. It used to offer the microwave as a de-chilling thing. But anyway, that was then. That was like, that used to be authentic. Now, you know, the two-point pour is where it's at, which is kind of funny.
And it's funny, though, just to look, I don't know how they're after managing to make what we would have grown up thinking of as an old man's kind of drink, that it's now so fashionable in a place called London, which is fashionable itself and a trendsetter in its own right.
Yeah.
And we could probably try and dissect that, but I don't know if there's any kind of special thing they do to start that, or is it just, you know, a cultural thing that's happening?
You can, I mean... you know, I regard Diageo as sort of the evil empire, because I'd say that they're capable of doing anything. They have vast promotional power, and yet you can't impose. Like Arthur's Day was a good example of this. They tried to invent that holiday, Arthur's Day, and despite their promotional power, it died. It was killed off by the public because it became associated with just too naked a form of drunkenness.
Yeah, and I don't know if I'm naive, but I just think there's something more organic happening about this. Frank, I want to turn to the article that you wrote, which was very funny, about the origins of Baby Guinness. Maybe what did you ever get to forgive the pun to the bottom of that?
Well, you know, this is bizarre because I had noticed this phenomenon in I'd only really noticed it in recent times, but it's at least 20 years old, of the shot drink called Baby Guinness, which, as you know, has no Guinness in it. It just looks like a little visual tribute to Guinness.
I didn't know it had Guinness in it.
No, it's three parts coffee liqueur, like Tia Maria or Kahlua, I think, and then a bit of Bailey's Irish Cream. So it looks like a little miniature pint, but no, it's liqueur, very sweet. And it's everywhere now, and I was sort of joking about how did Guinness, the all-powerful brewery, allow this to take off? Because it's a good ad for them in a way, but it is none of their product. And then I started digging around and I realised they used to have a product that they called Baby Guinness. It was, as I now know, it was also called the Snipe. It was one third of a pint. It was a little bottle and it was promoted to certain kinds of market, usually women. You know, it was said mothers who were short of iron could have a Snipe of Baby Guinness.
Yeah, because there was that tale, wasn't there, that it was good for...
Yeah, pregnant mothers. They used to deliver deliver Snipes of Guinness to maternity wards.
Yeah.
And... So I realized when basically Guinness owned the term, really, Baby Guinness. They'd had that, so they not only they lost the term to, you know, somebody else, but that they were now getting nothing. Ironically, even though doing very well from their basic product, they were getting nothing from this phenomenon called, and it's bizarre. This set off several weeks of letters from people about this is the power of the often letters to the paper about Guinness in all its sort of shapes and forms. Often it had nothing to do with the original piece. It was people with funny stories about working for Guinness or getting Guinness in maternity hospitals or doctors prescribing it for the patients. And this happened when the London Times recently
so
wrote about
just
the boom in Guinness. Yeah. There are all these stories as well. It's just a very powerful brand.
Why do you think it's so ubiquitous that people want to get involved?
It's very, for one thing, it's very strikingly visual. But a pint of Guinness, it's not unique. There are other black beers, but it's a very striking looking thing, and you see it, and it might be Murphy's or it might be Beamish's, but from a distance, you're going to say, pint of Guinness. You know what it is instantly. It looks wonderful. It's a beautiful looking thing, even if you hated the taste of it, and I suppose it's just been. It's been around for so long, and I suppose they're to get back to their promotional power. You know, some of their ads, like the thing we started with, many of their ads went on to become classics. They're part of broadcasting or art history. You know, the famous toucan ads that we still have some of, clocks around Dublin, men standing on penguins. Kind of absurd, but wonderfully colourful, and again completely striking. And you know, you instantly know that's Guinness. That's Guinness. Just a very powerful brand, which has, as somebody once said of Hollywood, it has colonised our subconsciousness for good or bad.
Well, it certainly has, and it's not stopping there. Its success is worldwide. But Frank, thank you very much for taking the time to come in and share your insights with us today. That was Frank McNally, chief writer of An Irish Diary with the Irish Times.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. And while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcasts from. My thanks, as always, to all of today's guests for giving us their very valuable time and insights. Thanks also to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy. Simon Keane was on research and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you do have any comments on today's items, please do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. We love hearing from you. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But for now, for me, Mandy Johnston, that was Taking Stock. Thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.